It is difficult to have a sermon on gluttony in the same week that Pringles announces pecan pie flavored chips. That's a challenge, and I just want you to know that. I haven't tried them yet, but I can hear the voice. It's calling. Okay, let's catch up on where we are. I think we have folks who are sort of used to the pace that we're making. We have worked most recently on 1 Kings chapter 8. Let me remind you of what was there. The temple has been finished. The last piece was the carrying of the Ark of the Covenant up to the temple itself and putting it in place. When that happened, God's glory filled the temple in the form of cloud. And Solomon followed that with a prayer, or perhaps two prayers, depending on whether you want to divide it, that are eloquent in calling on God to listen to prayers offered by his people in that place, to listen to the prayers of people who aren't yet his people offered in that place, to listen to prayers that are offered toward that place as people seek the Lord. And when that concluded, they had a sacrifice, which if you remember what we talked about in Exodus and Leviticus, when the sacrifice took place, part of it was burnt. That's why they call it a burnt offering, but part of it was not. And the part that was not, first, some of that was used as food for the priests and for the Levites, and some was used for what I see as simply a celebration meal with the family or the family and friends of whoever was offering the sacrifice. So if you come down to verse 62 of chapter 8 in 1 Kings, you get a sense of the size of the meal. This is a meal that encompasses all of the country. How many hamburgers did they have? Says they had 22,000 oxen, and you can make a whole bunch of hamburgers out of one oxen. How much mutton, how many plates of mutton did they serve? 120,000 sheep, a whole bunch of them. So the sacrifices were made, and the sacrifices became part of a celebration. I think we sometimes miss that connection. When that was finished, all of this took place, verse 65 says, for either a week or 2 weeks, depending on your translation. And at the end of that, verse 66, as the king dismissed the people, my translation says, the people bade farewell to the king. B-A-D-E, bade, is a word we don't use very much. Said farewell might be almost as good. And it says that the people went home, and it has two phrases to describe them. One is joyful, and one is happy of heart. What does yours say at that spot? Glad, joyful. Why were they glad? Why were they joyful and happy of heart? Mine says, over the goodness which the Lord had shown to his servants, I take that to be Solomon, and to his people Israel. Chapter 9. Verse 1 of chapter 9 tells you that this was the point at which one could now say Solomon had finished. What had he finished? Says he had finished building the temple, he had finished building the royal palace, and he had finished building, my translation says, everything else he wanted to do. Does yours have that kind of phrasing? Okay. Come down to verse 10. How long did this take? Come down to verse 10. How long did this take? 20 years. Another place somewhere in here says one of the two, and I forget whether it's the palace or the temple, took 7 years, the other one took 13 years. So that 20-year period has gone. When it says he built, in verse 1, the temple and the royal palace and everything else he wanted to build, what does that encompass? If you start at verse 15, it tells you what he built. Mine says in verse 1, verse 15, he built the temple of the Lord. He built his own palace. And what else did he build?
Supporting terraces and the wall of Jerusalem.
Yeah, something called the millo. Yours translates that as supporting terraces. Nobody's real sure perfectly what the millo is. And then it says, and fortifications for Jerusalem. But there's not a period after Jerusalem. There's a comma. So he's fortifying a whole bunch of places. It tells you about he's built the fortifications of Jerusalem. He's built, by implication, the fortifications of Hazor, Megiddo, a place that might be pronounced geezer, except makes people my age a little nervous. And then there's a whole verse that gives a commentary about that particular city. It picks up again just before verse 18. Fortifications of Lower Beth Horon, Baalath, Tamar out in the desert, and other fortifications inside the country, all of the storage towns owned by Solomon, all the towns for his chariots and horses, as well as whatever Solomon was pleased to build in Jerusalem, in Lebanon, and in all the countries under his rule. Okay? Now, look at that list, and let's just talk about a couple of things. It says there he was building fortifications for the towns in which he stored his horses and his chariots. What does that mean? I invited the first hour to think about the Pony Express. Now, few of you are quite old enough to have been around when the Pony Express was in function. The first hour had a little bit better chance. But you remember that, right? What was the Pony Express's purpose? Was to move mail across the country in the time before the railroads had been put in, right? And so how did they do it? Young men would hop on a horse and would ride as fast as they could. How far?
To the relay station.
15 or 20 miles, which was about as far as a horse could run without collapsing. And then back off just a little bit because you didn't want to... Let me pause for just a minute. I have a photograph now on my iPhone. My car has a panel, and up on the panel it says fuel range. So you've got the needle going down, and when it gets far enough down, a little orange light comes on. As it keeps going down, the orange light gets brighter and brighter and brighter. It's just a floodlight. On the panel, it has mileage range, which means this is how far you can drive until you run out of gas. Okay, this thing was glowing like a beacon on Saturday. I went to work Saturday morning, didn't leave myself quite enough time to fill up. I knew I was low, but I didn't get going fast enough. I got it down to 2 miles left in my range, and this thing glowing like a son of a gun. So, you know, you don't want to go quite that far, 15, 20 miles, something like that, and you put, I think you said a relay station. Somebody said that, right? And then what do you have at the relay station?
Horses.
And he hops on a fresh horse and rides how far?
The next
15 or 20 miles till the next day. You keep going all the way across the country, right? Which means that you have to have provisions out there in all these places, right? And what does this say Solomon had? It implies he had all out over the country was not relay stations for the Pony Express. What did he have? Garrisons for soldiers and for chariots, right? And so he's fortifying those. What's the second thing he says he fortified out there? It says storage towns owned by Solomon. That's what mine says. Does yours say something like that? That was in verse 18, just before the mention of the chariots and horses. Mine says towns for storage and towns for the horses and chariots. Does yours say that? Raz, your brow is furrowed.
Yeah, it says store cities.
Store cities.
Store cities, yeah.
Okay, that's the same thing. Okay, what's that for? What happens if you bring all the food into the capital? It's got to go right back out because you've got things out there that have to be provisioned for. Plus, if you have it all in one place and anything wrong starts to happen with the food where the food can't be used, then all the food is gone. So you want to disperse that some, but you also want it guarded. And so that's the picture I have is that he's putting fortifications that would protect soldiers and equipment, fortifications that would protect the food storage and things of this sort, and disperse them across the country. And all that's being built. So far, okay?
Yeah, it says he had 40,000 stalls of horses back in chapter 4, so you kind of doubt that all.
Yeah.
Heck of a central.
Okay, everybody okay? So that's sort of what they're talking about in verse 1. Now, let's come back to verse 1. When Solomon had finished all of this, there's a comma for mine at the end of verse 1, and verse 2 says what? Lord appeared to him for the second time. When was the first time the Lord appeared to him? That's where, not what was going on at that time. What was going on when the Lord appeared to him the first time?
Asked him what he wanted.
Yes, but what was going on with him when that time came? Do you remember? He had just been named king. And I tried to point out to you, there has the look of palace intrigue around that time. It was not a clean ascension to the throne. there was a rival. One of his brothers thought he should have it and was in the process of taking it when some things happened with Nathan and with Bathsheba and with Solomon that propelled Solomon to the throne and cost his brother his life. Remember all that? God appears to him in part, I think, to make sure Solomon knew that he was in God's will and God was blessing his ascension to the throne. And also, God offered him, tell me what you want. And he asked for wisdom, and God said, you've asked well, and gave him wisdom and said he'd give him all kinds of other things as well. So this is now the second time God is appearing. What has just happened? Chapter 8. What has just happened? I've obviously failed you. Yes, and what did Solomon do as part of that? He prayed one of the most powerful prayers that's ever been recorded in the Old Testament. Maybe two prayers, depending on whether you cut it at one point, because it does change direction partway through. So when God appears to him this time, what's God's purpose? His God's purpose, I think, is to affirm to him that his prayer has been heard and God is answering it. Watch what it says. God appeared to Solomon a second time, just as he had at Gibeon. And the Lord said to him, this is verse 3, what's the first thing he says? I heard your prayer. Wouldn't that be nice? Wouldn't that be nice? I can think of nothing that honors his prayer any more than the fact that God comes to him and says, I heard your prayer. And he begins to tick off all the things that were in Solomon's prayer and affirms that God is ready to move on those things. I've heard your prayer and the entreaty which you brought before me. I consecrate this temple which you built. I place my name there forever. My eyes and my heart will be there always. And then he says, for your part, remember how part of his prayer was, you promised to David that a son of his would always be on the throne. Now, Lord, keep that promise. He says, for your part, if you walk before me in innocence of heart and in honesty like your father David, if you do everything I command and keep my laws and my ordinances, I will make your royal throne secure over Israel forever, just as I promised your father David that I would do. And I promised him this by saying, and then he quotes what he said back then. What does verse 6 start with? What's the first word in verse 6 for you? That's the way mine starts. What, that has a little ominous tone to it. What does it suggest? That his response to that prayer is conditional. It's implied already, but now he's making it really firm. But if you turn away from me, either you or your descendants, and instead of keeping my commandments and laws, which I've laid down for you, you go and serve other gods and worship them, then I'll banish, mine says banish, what does yours say? Cut off Israel from the country I've given them, and I will disown this temple, which I've consecrated in my name. And Israel will be a proverb and a byword among all peoples. And as for this once exalted temple, everyone who passes by will be, my translation says, appalled. What does yours say at that spot?
Astonished.
Astonished, yours says. What else?
Shocked.
Say whatever happened here.
Mine says they'll whistle.
It's a scoff.
Woo!
It's a scoff.
It's sort of a woo. Yeah. One translation, maybe two, says scoff or scorn. Mine just says they'll whistle and say, oh my goodness, woo! I can hear a something like that. And then they will say, what will they say? Why has the Lord treated this country and this temple like this? And the answer will be, what? Because they deserted the Lord their God, who brought their ancestors out of Egypt. Because they adopted other gods. Because they worshipped other gods. Because they served other gods. That is why the Lord has brought all these disasters on them.
That's what is behind this God-visited devastation.
Mm-hmm. Now look at what God has said. God has said, you prayed a prayer. And I'll say editorially, this is just me, I think it's one of the best prayers you'll ever read in the Old Testament. And God is saying, I'll do everything you said, as long as you do everything that I said. How's that going to go for Solomon? Have you done what I asked you to do? Read the rest of this book? How's that go? Not very well. Why not? Because Solomon doesn't do the thing God said. What does Solomon have to do to secure all the things he's asking of God? All he has to do is follow God's laws and commandments. And David has already shown that can be done. David's already shown that can be done with terrible, terrible falling off the path and crawling back on it. The choir in the first hour sang an anthem, the title of which is Restore My Joy. It starts, create in me a clean heart, O God, and renew a right spirit within me. Restore to me the joy of my salvation. That was David's prayer. It wasn't that David never left the straight and narrow. Good Lord, it's not that. What is it? It is when he left the straight and narrow, he knew he had left, and he was immediately beginning to work to try to come back.
I had sinned against the Lord.
It is not that Solomon's only hope was perfect obedience. That's not likely that anybody's going to do that. But what it says is when you fail, you seek God's forgiveness instead of persisting in that failure. So when he says, I think the most important thing is not keep my laws and my commandments. I think the most important thing is as your father David did. Because I think that unconditions part of the conditions. You hear me? Now, that takes us to verse 10. And when you get to verse 10, the decline starts. When you get to verse 10, the decline starts. Mine says it took 20 years for Solomon to erect the two buildings, the temple of the Lord and the royal palace. Mine does not have a punctuation mark. It has a new verse and it has a parenthesis. It has a new verse and it has a parenthesis. The parenthesis tells you a little bit about Hiram. It tells you what he gave to Solomon to build all this stuff. What did he give? Mine says all the cedar wood that he wanted, all the juniper wood that he wanted, and all the gold he wanted. Hiram gave him that. And then the parenthesis closes, and then the verse keeps going. So let's read verse 10 and then go into the middle of verse 11 at the end of that ellipsis. And it reads like this. At the end of 20 years that it took Solomon to erect the two buildings, the temple of the Lord and the royal palace, King Solomon gave to Hiram 20 towns in the territory of Galilee. That's up in the north of the country. Okay? Verse 12, Hiram came to inspect the towns, and what was his conclusion? Worthless was one translation offered in the first hour. Does anybody have that one? Good for nothing was another. Does anybody have that one? I see somebody nodding. You've got that one. Mine says simply, he was not pleased. What kind of towns are these you have given me, brother? He asks. And to this day, they are known as, and the phrase it says, is its meaning is not perfectly known, but it seems to be worthless country or something like that. Okay. Now, I told the first hour a story at this point, and I think I will ask you to indulge me on that. A couple of weeks ago, Barbara and I took a Sunday off. We weren't here. I think on that Sunday, Cameron was teaching, and Cameron, I want to say publicly that I thank you for that. I do really appreciate that, and I hope that things went well enough that maybe you'll do it again someday. In any event, we took off towards West Virginia, and we had plans of a couple of places to go, but they weren't firm plans, and we didn't have a plan of where we were going to spend the night. I had an iPhone, and I was able to look up some places we might stay in White Sulphur Springs, and we decided that they were more expensive than we wanted to spend. Those of you who have me as a friend on Facebook, you may have seen a picture I posted of the Greenbrier, and I put the caption, at the Greenbrier, and a whole bunch of people in the first hour thought we were staying there. No. We walked in, took a picture, walked out at the Greenbrier. So we looked at the next town down the line, which is a little town called Lewisburg, And the first one we checked in said, we don't have any rooms, but we think there's rooms at this other one. And we checked, and they had one room left, maybe two. And it was at a price that we thought, okay, we can afford that. And we spent the night. And as we walked in to check in, we said to the person at the desk, every room is filled at this other place. Nearly every room is filled here. What's filling all the rooms? And you would think it might be people going to see the leaves. But that was still 2 weeks away. The peak doesn't come at that time in October. It comes later than that. So they weren't coming for the leaves. And the woman says, oh, tomorrow is the festival. The festival. I said, the festival? Oh, yeah. They block off the whole of the downtown. This is four blocks. Right? They block off the whole of the downtown, fill it with little tents with various things, mostly food, and then they have musicians sprinkled around. It's really wonderful. Well, we went down there for supper and sort of saw what it was going to be like, and it was wonderful. That is a beautiful little town with a very functioning downtown. They had a Walmart two miles away, and it had not killed anything, it seemed like, in this downtown. In my hometown, they put in a Walmart. The downtown looks like you turned off a bomb. It just, nothing there. Okay? This little place, we decided we'd stay an extra night. We spent the day in Lewisburg, and we walked up and down, listened to the musicians. Turned out one of the musicians is an old guy I used to work with a long time ago. We hadn't seen each other in 20 years or so. And we said hi and sort of sniffed each other like big dogs sometimes do. But it was really nice. And I thought to myself as I read this, Lewisburg would not have been a worthless town, but the place I grew up might have been viewed that way. It's actually not that bad a town, but you come and look at the downtown and you think, well, this is worthless. And I think of that. Now, here's my question. If Solomon is following God's laws and commandments, what's he going to do? He's going to treat other people the way he would want to be treated. Is he doing that with Hiram? He is not. The decline is coming. The decline is coming.
Especially since Hiram has given him all that stuff
to build. Yeah. He had sent the king 120 talents of gold. Somebody said each talent was about $30,000. And we think the translation is two decades old, so you know who knows what it is now. $3.5 million, I think you said. And that's, so maybe that's $30 million today. $100 million. I don't know. We went down into verse 15, and we looked a little bit at stuff down in there, right? All the things he was building. But I didn't draw attention to the first part of verse 15. We jumped to the last part of verse 15. What does the first part of verse 15 say? Verse 15. It talks about forced labor. That is not compensated labor. That is not voluntary labor. That is, at the point of a spear, you're going to do what the king says. What kind of attitude toward the king is going to be built up by that? Not a particularly good one. Now, it does say a little bit further down, verse 20, it says, who was subject to this? There's some thought that maybe this isn't worded in a way that comes across correctly, but at least look at verse 20. What does it say? Who were the people subjected to the forced labor? You might start out thinking it says all, but that's not what it says. It says all of what? All of those who survived. They tried to kill these whole people groups. And the ones that were left, they're the ones that were brought into forced labor. He says in verse 22, that he didn't impose forced labor on the Israelites. But he sure as heck imposed them on somebody, because in a later chapter you're going to see maybe it was just the people of Judah that he imposed this on. I don't know. It was clear the people of Judah were subject to forced labor, some of them. And I think some of them from the north would have been as well. So this may be a word that distinguishes between north and south. But in any event, he had all this forced labor going on. He's sure not treating those people the way he would want to be treated. And then it says in verse 23 how many overseers there were, how many foremen there were for this project. How many? 550. Now I want to flag that sentence because one of those 550 is going to pop out to be really, really important. Have you had a chance to read the rest of 1 Kings? Have you had a chance to read the rest of it? If you have, you'll know the name of one of these people. It was, in fact, the person that ended up elevated to being in charge of all the foremen. Well, we're not going to say the name today, but just there's a name coming. There's a name coming. Keep an eye on that. Verse 24, it says he built the millo, those fortified terraces, I think you called them, Greg. After he built, just before he built the millo, it says, Pharaoh's daughter moved from the city of David up to the palace which he had built for her. If you remember, he built a palace that included lavish quarters for himself and lavish quarters for all of his wives. We're going to find out later how many that is. 25, three times a year, he presented burnt offerings and probably had a celebration like the one that we saw at the end of verse of chapter 8. And in that way, he completed the temple. Verse 26, 27, 28, he goes into partnership with Hiram one more time. And what's he doing with Hiram this time? Building ships. Who's going to be manning the ships? Verse 27 says, Hiram is going to send experienced sailors to serve along with those in Solomon's service. You sort of figure Solomon sent the soldiers and Hiram sent the sailors. Does Hiram have the expertise for sailors where he is? Where's Hiram from?
Tyre.
The other city-state that's nearby is Sidon. And you're going to see Sidon mentioned in just a few minutes. Tyre and Sidon, we believe, were part of the ancient country of Phoenicia. That name doesn't make it in here, but Tyre and Sidon are the capital cities of that region. What was Phoenicia known for more than anything else? The best sailors anywhere in this part of the world. We believe that sailors from Phoenicia made it all over the globe. There's some evidence they made it to the New World way, way back. Certainly made it all the way into Africa, over to India. These were the experienced sailors. So this is a very real kind of thing. And what was the purpose? Where did they go? Verse 28. Mine doesn't have a footnote, and I forgot to look up exactly where this is, but they went somewhere named Ophir. Maybe that's where Oprah lived. And took on how much gold? How much did Hiram give Solomon to do all the building he was doing? 120. How much are they bringing back? 420. So whatever he had had before, this dwarfs it. Okay?
Mine says 16 tons.
16 tons, deeper in debt.
What do you get?
Yeah, what do you get? Another day older and deeper in debt. St. Peter, don't you call me because I can't come. I owe my soul to the country. You remember Tennessee Ford singing that thing? Yeah. 16 tons, it says, huh?
That's
12 million. 12 million, yeah, four times as much.
So what did Hiram get?
One doesn't know.
Maybe deeper.
Because it says they brought back 420 talents of gold, which they brought back to, doesn't say Solomon and Hiram, it just says Solomon.
Right.
I'm treating them that. Okay, now, verse 10, chapter 10 is a kind of an insert. The majority of it is an insert.
Let me ask you a question. This gold, what do we think it was for? Just for the treasury or for the temple? For the final, I mean, had they finished all the decorations, the ceiling?
It could be for Fort Knox. The picture is everything's been finished by now, and they're just building up the treasury.
Okay.
I don't know, but it sounds like...
How did they just come back with that much gold?
They mined it.
Huh? They mined it?
Or they took it away from whoever mined it.
The precious stone, silver, ivory, apes, right. And bamboo.
There's a book that was written that said when you look at what England did in exploiting the New World and what Spain did in exploiting the New World, Spain went after gold. England went after productive land. And that England won the battle because they didn't go after gold. Spain said the only thing that matters is gold, and they went after gold. And you remember, some of that was just, you know, fill this room with gold and maybe we'll let your king live. Some of you who know a little about history will remember that story. Spain went after gold. England went after productive land populated with people from England or people that England could control. And it made a huge difference in the influence of the Western Hemisphere. So something like that may be hiding in here. Now, chapter 10 is an interlude. The decline that I was telling you to look at, that's going on. But somebody comes in who doesn't see it. What this person sees is the glory, not the rot that's inside the glory. And that's okay. Who is this person? In the first hour I said the Queen of Sheba. And then I corrected myself. It is Solomon and Sheba. It is not Solomon and Sheba. So get that straight today, right? I admit having made that mistake when we get past that, right? The Queen of Sheba heard of Solomon's fame and came to test him with, mine says, difficult questions. Hard questions. A nice woman sitting about where Rusty is sitting said, hard questions. And I heard odd. I did not hear hard. We had, if you want to listen to the lesson sometime, that'd be a good point to listen to when I misunderstand. Hard questions.
The message said, she came to put his reputation to the test.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. You're supposed to know everything. Let's see what you know. Right. Now, let's pause for just a minute. Where is Sheba? If she's the queen of Sheba, there must be a place called Sheba. Where is that?
Saudi Arabia.
Don't think so, but maybe.
Near Ophir?
Well, could be. Could be. I think it's modern-day Ethiopia plus Eritrea, that it would, those countries have split in our day, but it would be south of Egypt along the, I guess it would be the Red Sea. That's the country that I think she would have come from. Okay? She arrived in Jerusalem with a very large retinue, with camels laden with spices, and an immense quantity of gold and precious stones. Having reached Solomon, she discussed with him everything she had in mind. How's this going with your translation? Is it more or less fitting with yours? Mm-hmm. She discussed with him everything she had in mind, and Solomon had an answer to all of her questions. Not one of them was too obscure for the king to answer for her. I've learned in the last decade a different way of responding to people. When my students ask me a question, I very often say, I don't know that I have an answer, but I have a response. There's a great safety in that. That word is not used here. It doesn't say he had a response for everything. He had an answer for everything. His wisdom was on display. Now, verse 4 in my translation starts in a very interesting way. When the queen of Sheba saw. That's another place where you can get that H in the wrong place. When the queen of Sheba saw. Does yours have that?
Experience.
Experience, yours says? Perceived. Perceived, yours says? Okay. What was it that she saw, experienced, or perceived? I'd like to count these things. So I want somebody, each time we hit one, I want you to put up another finger. Okay? What's the first thing that she saw? Mine says she saw his wisdom. So hold up one finger, somebody. Okay, there's at least one person with a finger up. What's the next thing she saw?
Palace.
The palace which she built. Hold up a second finger. What's the next thing?
Food
at his table. Have you guys been to worship this morning? Did you hear the preacher read Proverbs 23? You sit at the king at his table, put a knife to your throat if you're a man of appetites, if you're given to gluttony. You better not, those delicacies are dangerous. You remember that? Okay. She saw the food at his table. This was the king of, this was a king the likes of which hadn't been seen before. So that's number three. What's number four? Okay, now what mine says the accommodation for his officials, which could be where he had for them to live, it could be where he had for them to work. I don't know. Does yours give a different word that would help us understand that?
Seating.
Okay, I'm thinking it could be the cubicles in which they work. You know, sort of picture people working in an office and theirs was just... There's one place where the faculty members are at the University of Richmond. If you ever get over there, you ought to see this place. There's a building on campus that was the first building built on the new campus when the campus was new in 1914. And they had a library built. The floor, the room had a ceiling two floors up, a vaulted ceiling with big Gothic arches and all kinds of wooden filigree, wide open. And what they've done is they've put in wooden partitions to make the offices, but there's no roof. So all of this is up there. I tell you, I don't really want to work up there because it's too far from my instruments and too far from my labs. but that's a cool place to have an office. And I'm picturing something like that. The seating, when you say that, I'm thinking of the place they work. But whatever that means, it's something about his officials in my translation. The next word I have has the word staff. So if yours had attending servants, yours said waiters. Mine says the organization of his staff, and this is another finger goes up. There's two fingers on this one. The first, he says, is the organization of his staff, the way they did the service, and it also says their attire. Mine says the way they were dressed. Okay? This is almost too easy, and therefore I should apologize for it. But have you seen the pictures from Nixon's administration of the people who blew the trumpets just before Nixon came in? It was sort of the height of the imperial presidency. They had these people in long coats with gold filigree, and they had these long trumpets, and when Nixon would walk into a room, blow all this stuff. I'm picturing that. So here's the waiters, and the waiters, they never bump into each other. Everything's just so smooth and all this, and man, the way they were dressed. How far are we now? You keeping track? Are we up at six?
That was
a double. Yeah, that should have been two. Okay, here's number seven. What's that? His cupbearers. Yours says crystal, so that means the things they drank from. The cupbearers could be those people who were in attendance on him to make sure his food wasn't poisoned. That's usually the way we think of that, especially in light of Nehemiah later on. And then finally, the offerings that he presented to the temple of the Lord. And mine says it left her breathless. What does yours say?
Overwhelmed,
yours says.
No more spirit in her.
I think that's less good, but it still captures something. She's just breathless, except she's got enough breath to say something. So, verse 6, I guess it is. She said to the king, "The report I heard in my own country about your wisdom and the handling of your affairs was true then. But until I came and saw for myself, I didn't believe the reports. Clearly, I was told less than half. For in wisdom and in prosperity, you surpass what was reported to me." And then verse 8 gets funny. Or at least I think so. What's her first statement? How happy must be your wives? I'm sorry. I find that funny. Yours has another word? Mine follows that. How fortunate are your wives? Now, there's a footnote there, and the footnote says, I like that because the next sentence says, "How fortunate are these servants of yours, continually in attendance on you, able to listen to your wisdom." And the implication is day after day. Okay. Now, it is my contention that there is rot that she's not seeing. She's seeing the splendor. She's seeing all the beauty and the glory. She's not seeing the forced labor. She's not seeing the shortchanging of the people who are helping him to do these things. She's not seeing the lust and gluttony. I think the preacher said it very, very well. It's not just food. It's the seeking of excess and abundance beyond abundance. He had 120 talents and he's going after 400 more. What's he going to do with that?
See in his heart, unlike David's, his heart is going towards conceit.
Well, we're going to see that more clearly later. But I all I'm saying is I think you can see the division from where the Lord said he needed to be and where he is. And she's not seeing that. She's seeing the splendor and the glory. But, verse 9, she's called back. And I think verse 9 is very much to her credit. She does not praise Solomon. Who does she praise? "Blessed be the Lord your God, who has shown you his favor by setting you on the throne of Israel. Because of his everlasting love for Israel, he has made you king to administer law and justice." And then she presented the king with a present. What was the first piece of her present? Think about verse 14 back in chapter 9 before you answer. What's the first thing? 120 talents of gold. The same amount of gold that Hiram had given him. Along with great quantities of spices and precious stones. And the historian makes a comment, "No such wealth of spices ever came again like those which the Queen of Sheba gave to King Solomon. Similarly, Hiram's fleet, which had brought the gold from Ophir, had also brought back great cargoes. Cargoes of what? Timber and precious stones. And it talks about the timber. It says the timber was used by the king to make supports for the temple of the Lord and for the royal palace, and to make harps and lyres for the musicians. No more of this timber has since come or been seen to this day, which means that the fleets must not have started after all the building was over, but were actually starting back in that time because some of the material was used in the building. Has anybody heard about Stradivarius violins? Why are they so valuable? Not because they're old. It's because of the quality of the sound that it produces. Now, what are the theories about how that sound is unique to those instruments? One theory is the wood, and one theory is the resins and the glue and some of the other things. If it's the wood, then this kind of sounds like that. There's something about a special kind of wood that came in, and he used it, he used it for pillars that nobody's ever going to see because they're all going to be covered over. But you also use it for musical instruments. And I think about the wood that people say is so special in the Stradivarius.
Is the Message calls it sandalwood.
Sandalwood, it says. Oh. King Solomon, in turn, verse 13, presented the Queen of Sheba with everything that she expressed a wish for, along with those presents which he gave her with a munificence worthy of King Solomon. Mine uses the word munificence there. What does yours say? Does it use such a glorious word? This is verse 13. Bounty, yours says.
Royal bounty.
The royal bounty. Uh-huh. After that, she went home to her own country. Starting at verse 14, it starts to list for you some of the riches that Solomon was accumulating. All the gold, 666 talents of gold. Does anybody notice verse 14? I forgot to point this out in the first hour. How many talents so far? No. Look at that number. I wonder why. I don't know. Is this just accidental that the number? I don't know. I do suggest that that's an interesting number to see. And just as you go by, just note that. Okay? He talks about gold and ivory. Verse 19 and verse 20, he's got 14 lions on attendance, two right next to his throne and 12 more spread out across the throne room. Verse 21 ends with an interesting phrase. Silver was little thought of in Solomon's day. Do you see that line? No matter who came to him, verse 25, they would always bring a present. Things made of silver, things made of gold, robes, armor, spices, horses, mules, and this went on year after year after year. Verse 27, in Jerusalem the king made silver as common as rocks. Talks about horses coming from here, chariots coming from there. Tells you something about the price that was paid for those. Solomon was rich beyond riches. And we come to the end of verse of chapter 10. That means we have very little time left for chapter 11. So let's see how far we can get. Because I wanted you to end in the same place that the first hour ended.
If you think of chapter 10 as showing you the glory,
the splendor.
Possible. You know, God made this all possible for him.
Right.
It was there, the potential glory to God.
And he had everything he needed.
God had made it possible for him to have all of this, it's there. And the world could see it. And they knew Solomon was there because God put
and him there. And Sheba says, God put you here.
Yeah.
God gave you this.
And if you think of it in that way,
what he could have done.
At this point.
Right.
It could have just been praise to God.
Verse 1, chapter 11. King Solomon loved women. King Solomon loved many women. King Solomon loved many foreign women.
Mine has that word, however.
Yours has however? Yeah. Back to the rot, you could almost say. Not only Pharaoh's daughter, but women, plural, from Moab, Edom, Sidon, and from the Hittites. From those people of whom the Lord had said to the Israelites, you are not to go among them, nor they among you, or they will be sure to sway your hearts. to their own gods. I'm not going to take time to give you all of the chapter and verse for places that you can go back in Genesis and Deuteronomy and other places to see this, but if you want to see the list, you can look on my page afterwards. End of verse 2. Solomon was deeply attached to them. He had 700 wives of royal rank. It doesn't say he had 700 wives. He just says of the wives he had, 700 of them had royal rank. And he had 300 concubines besides. Verse 4, when Solomon grew old, his wives swayed his heart to other gods, and his heart was not wholly with the Lord his God as his father David's had been. Very, very quick commentary. Through the rest of 1 Kings and all of 2 Kings, every time there's a king, there's going to be this assessment of where that king was. I've got a page I'll give you. I started to give it to you today, but I think I'll give it to you next week, that has a list of all the kings. And next to the ones that please God, I've got a capital P as a subscript. Next to the ones like Solomon that partly pleased him, I've got a little squiggle, tilde, for those of you who know that symbol. The ones that displeased him, I've got a D. A few of them have a D plus. It is appalling to look at that list. And I simply observe, I wonder what God's judgment would be about whether our leaders are pleasing him or partly pleasing him or displeasing him. I'll leave you to think about that as we go on. Verse 5, Solomon became a follower of Astarte, the goddess of the Sidon, and of Milcom, the abomination of Ammon. He did what is displeasing to the Lord. He was not a wholehearted follower of the Lord as his father David had been. Then it was that Solomon built a high place for Chemosh, the abomination of Moab, and to Milcom, the abomination of Ammon. He did the same for all of his foreign wives who offered incense and sacrifice to their gods. Verse 9, and God was angry with Solomon. We're going to stop there, but let me make one observation. Those three that he's pulled out for special notice, one of those, you worship that God by having sex with temple prostitutes. The second one, you worship that God by having sex with male prostitutes in the temple or in the house of worship. So when males would come to worship, they would have sex with females. When the females would come, they would have sex with males. The third one, you worship that God by taking your children and throwing them into the open mouth of the idol where flames were going, and you burned your children alive. When you see a civilization that sacrifices its children, kills its children, and thinks they are doing it something right, you see a civilization with problems. I will not take that thought any further, but I think it applies to us. I think it applies to our citizens.
Unwanted, I mean, like abortion.
No. Well, I think that's the parallel I'm making, and I don't want to go any further with that right now. In this case, it was they took healthy children and just said, this is the way I worship my God. In some ways, what we're doing may be worse. But I'm simply saying, you see this thing just declining like crazy. Most people think, okay, there was a decline across the kingdom period that ended with God taking them into exile. First the northern kingdom with Assyria, then the southern kingdom with Babylon. What you see here is there was not a decline. There was a falling off the cliff and then a decline with maybe a few positive bumps along the way. The worst of what happened happened while Solomon was still alive. And you start looking later on, we're going to look back at this and you'll see a couple of kings would come along and they'd try to clean out some of this stuff. And the stuff they were cleaning out had been there since Solomon was king. This is not a decline that is linear. This is a decline that's off the cliff and then goes. And it's within just a few years of setting up the temple. That borders on unbelievable. And the historian says what happened, it's because back in the Old Testament, don't have anything to do with Ammon, don't have anything to do with Moab. Don't mingle. You're not to go among them, nor they among you, or they will be sure to sway your hearts to their gods. And all that is fulfilled right here. Verse 9, God was angry with Solomon, and that's where we start next time. Let's have a word of prayer as we go. Our Father, these are hard sections to read. We think if someone has the wisdom that Solomon has, how could he possibly miss the signs of what was about to happen? And yet he did. we suddenly realize, if we stop to think about it, the promise you made to him, you might be making to us. Follow your laws and your commandments, and you will establish us on the earth. We realize first, none of us are going to do that. We realize that David has taught us, when we fail, if we repent and return, you will honor that, and you will bring us back into right relationship. And so we claim the verses in the New Testament that say all of us have sinned and come short of the glory of God, but that while we were yet sinners, your Son died for us. We pray that you would help us understand the meaning and truth of those words, so that our hearts can be filled with gratitude, and that that will help us to listen when your Spirit calls and guides and directs. For we ask all this in your Son's name. Amen.